Hello and welcome to the AP Top 25 College Football Podcast. I'm Ralph Russo, college football writer with the Associated Press. In an annual tradition, Bruce Feldman from Fox Sports and The Athletic and Stuart Mandel from The Athletic, they are partners on the Audible podcast. They join me to go over their lists of the top 25 coaches in college football right now. With Nick Saban retiring, Jim Harbaugh jumping back into the NFL, and coaches such as Dabo Sweeney, Lincoln Riley, and to a lesser degree, Ryan Day, hitting rough spots in the last couple of years, it caused Bruce and Stu to really shake up the rankings and make room for some new entries into the top 10. I'll give you my top 10 in Three and Out and the show notes. Thanks for listening to the AP Top 25 College Football Podcast. You can find us at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, just about anywhere you like to get your pods. If you like what you hear, please give us a good rating and review. It helps college football fans find us. It helps us find more college football fans. And away we go. Joining me this week on the show, it's almost like a tradition. So Bruce Feldman from Fox and The Athletic and Stuart Mandel from The Athletic do their top 25 coaches currently in college football. They do their lists. I read their list. I criticize their list, and I bring them on the show to yell at them. It's not going to be quite like that today. Bruce and Stu, thank you so much for joining me as always. Appreciate your time and appreciate your lists.
I appreciate you scolding Stu when he goes outside the lines too much. And I'll be disappointed if you don't zing him a little bit.
Maybe a little, though I think actually the biggest complaint I may have had is on your list, Bruce, but we'll get to that in a second. Stu, okay. Yes,
it's a new world.
I will try not to gang up on you, Stu. As usual, your list tends to be a little more volatile, a little more year to year. Bruce's list tends to be a little more, body of work, a little more what have you done not just for me lately. I want to get into it with this, because without Nick Saban around and with Dabo Sweeney having gone through, I think you can call three kind of meh years in a row. Certainly last year is the worst year at Clemson since his early days. It's just presented a new world in college football very much and made these lists, I would imagine, and I'll start with you, Stu, a lot harder to do.
Yeah, this was the hardest ever since for however many years I've been doing it because of what you just said. I mean, it was the combination of, who I would have had as two of the top three are gone. And then guys who, I think I've had Lincoln Riley in the top five every year since he became a head coach. But that became impossible to justify the way things have trended down with his program. Ryan Day's got his Michigan problem. Dabo's, failed to embrace one of the most important parts of the sport. So it just left this big gaping void in like that, after Kirby Smart segment.
So Bruce, I'm sure you went through something similar. How did you start weighing you guys had some pretty drastic movers on these lists this year. And Bruce, you tend to be one who isn't as radical as far as changing from year to year, but I guess you kind of had to a certain degree.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, because it wasn't just, obviously Nick Saban was the big ticket item, but you also had Jim Harbaugh, who just won a national title, who probably would have been third behind Saban and Kirby, but now he's in the NFL. So you take that away. And then, Stu's right. Like, you had Ryan Day, he still got a remarkable record, but it's 3 years in a row they lost to Michigan. They had the clunker of a showing against Mizzou. I get it. They were basically down to their third string quarterback. But that was different. I think then you have the upstart guys, and it's weird to call Lance Leipold is almost 60 an upstart, but like, I think we'd always had a lot of respect for him, but now I think you had to give him even more of a lift. And then there's Kalen DeBoer, as an amazing record. I mean, I had him on my list last year, but he's got to be a top five coach. And then when I look at what he's done, you have this cluster of maybe five coaches, I would say, who are in this realm, whether it was, you know, who are really good coaches, Ryan Day, Lincoln Riley, Brian Kelly, James Franklin. And I would put the first two coaches, Ryan Day and Lincoln Riley, in similar categories in that they were really good offensive coaches who ended up taking over programs that were kind of ready-made. And then you had the other two guys who almost always have really good teams, but they can't get, you know, when they play the elite teams, they get smacked around. And, you know, then the other one who to me was kind of a, you know, a guy who took a big step was Mike Norvell. You know, they started out 13-0. They went 13-1 at Florida State, did a really good job at Memphis. I think we all know how bad the situation he took over at Florida State from first from Jimbo Fisher and then obviously from Willie Taggart. So it was a lot of shakeup there, right? I mean, you know, and I don't want to jumpstart, you know, in this direction, but like, yes, Dabo has definitely backslid at Clemson. But to me, he was still the obvious choice to have number two because he's won two national titles. And I just don't, you know, in Stu's case, I saw how far he dropped him. I was like, I don't think you get how hard it is to win a national title in college football. And he won two of them, you know, and he beat Nick Saban. And yes, he has been not embraced the portal, and that has affected them. But even in the May years, they're 30-10. It's not like, I mean, there's very few coaches who would be 30-10 in the downside of their time. So that's why he was number two for me. And I thought it was hard to put anybody in front of him at this point.
Yeah, that's my one big complaint with you, Stu. And it is always my big complaint with you is that you're just these drastic swings and not having Dabo at number two, even after a couple of meh years, which look a lot better than most guys' meh years. I think the only reason why at this point Dabo's biggest problem is he's being compared to himself. After another year down year, we may be having a similar conversation again about Dabo and how he missed the 12-team playoff and maybe then. But as of right now, when all these other guys with big-time resumes leave the stage, Saban and Harbaugh in particular, and some of the others, you know, hit speed bumps, like I'll take Dabo's road, you know, bump in the road over most of the other guys who haven't even done anything near what Dabo has done.
But I think the difference is Dabo's bump in the road. There's more to it than just, like, obviously, for the most part, we're just looking at people's wins and losses. But in Dabo's case, you know, first of all, he went 4-4 in the ACC last year. It's not very good. But it's not just the record. It's not like, well, we had a, you know, too many injuries and we had a down year. Like, he is doing something or not doing something, I guess we would say. He's trying to win championships with one hand tied behind his back. I don't have much confidence in him right now. If I was saying which coaches do I have the most confidence in, I'm frankly not sure he would be in my top 10 because he's refusing to do something that is like, I mean, look at all these coaches that we have on here who, if it weren't for the transfer portal, would not be ranked anywhere near where they are, right? Mike Norvell, obviously, one that comes to mind.
Kalen DeBoer. I don't even put Lance Leipold in that category, Stu, though.
No, absolutely not. I mean, he's, for the most part, built the roster organically. But Mike Norvell got a 13-0 regular season last year, and most of the key players were transfers. You know, Kalen DeBoer isn't where he is at Washington without a transfer quarterback. So, you know, I think what Dabo is doing is it's not just, oh, he had a bad year. He only, you know, he lost four games for the first time in 13 years. It's negligent on his part to continue to pretend that that NIL and the portal aren't a key to winning in college football today.
Okay, let me jump in on Leipold here because he was the one, and it's hard for me to be the guy making the case against Lance Leipold because when he was at Buffalo, I was often having him toward the bottom of my list, thinking that I want to count what he did in Division III. I am a big fan of your winners win. Right. And that's the reason why I've always liked Brian Kelly. Guy never loses. No, he's been a lot of different places. You can nitpick his resume here and there. I probably would have still had him number three this year. I think who knows? Maybe I'll put a list together and put it in the show notes at some point or put it on Twitter. But I didn't do necessarily a list for the show because I wanted to steer the conversation some other direction. But so I hate being the one to argue against Lance Leipold. However, number two on Stu's list and number three on Bruce's list, that seems awfully aggressive. Now, again, I understand process of elimination. Who are you going to put there? But, man, that just seems – what he's done has been amazing. And I've been the guy who I felt like was almost a little bit ahead of the curve on him when he was at Buffalo. But it just seems like that bullet, wow, like number two with a bullet and number three with a bullet, that seems awfully aggressive, even compared to Kalen DeBoer to a certain degree, who, hey, he played for the national championship last year.
Well, I guess I would ask you, it sounds like you have Dabo number two on your hypothetical list. Who would be your number three?
Yeah, I think I would go still with Brian Kelly. And I might, and I could see Lance Leipold and DeBoer. I like the idea of sort of lumping those two guys together. But I guess I would find myself like looking at what he has done at Kansas the last couple of years and saying, that's amazing because that program was so deep into a ditch. But, you know, he has also still lost to Chris Klieman and Kansas State the last couple of years. And you know, you both have Klieman on your list. It just seems, you know, again, like it, this is not in a vacuum. So you have to have somebody. If that guy's not number three or number two, somebody else has to be.
Let me push back a little on the Brian Kelly one. Mm-hmm. He's a really good coach, but he's also 3-5 at LSU against top 25 opponents, and his teams get blown out of more big games than almost any good coach. I mean, he's 5-13 against top 10 teams since they got crushed in the national title game. That's not including that one by Alabama. I mean, yes, he's a really good coach, but to me, to have him, like, yeah, I get how it's going to be like kind of jarring to see the Kansas coach number three, or in Stu's case, number two. But like, and I don't want to co-opt Stu's logic, but if like you ask me, like, I definitely think, given what he's working with, I don't think Brian Kelly's going to Kansas and can do what he's done there, what Lance Leipold's done there. I think he could make them respectable, but I don't think he'd have them, like, turn them around like this, you know? And to me, that's why, you know, they had a team that was really talented last year with a bunch of, like, NFL talent in the front seven on defense. And they were really bad on defense. I mean, Florida State was up 42-17 on them with like a minute left in that game. You know, you had the Heisman winner and, you know, two probably top 15 pick receivers. And it wasn't that great of a team in a down year in the SEC West, you know? So I don't know. I think he's a top 10 coach. I think it's aggressive to keep him number three. And at the expense of Leipold, my two cents.
So, Stu, you were a little, sort of working. Well, actually, let's stick with DeBoer here, because DeBoer is going to be a fascinating case study as he goes from Washington, again, after only 2 years and only 2 years at Fresno State. And, you know, I think there's a fair amount of, I don't know, criticism, but like, let's say, an analytical look at DeBoer and sort of see what he's done the last 2 years at Washington and say, it is amazing. He has done a great job. But if I'm looking for like a way to poke a little hole in here, it is a lot of those players were already on the roster. Now, I understand he brought in Michael Penix, but that a lot of that team was already there.
But Ralph, isn't that helping the argument? A lot of those players were on the roster and they won four games the year before. He went there and they went 25-3 with almost the same roster, except he took a quarterback who, by the way, he had success with at Indiana, but that quarterback was reeling. Yeah. So he revitalized Michael Penix Jr., turned him into, to me, the best quarterback in the country last year. And they, you know, they went 10-1 against top 25 opponents. I think the fact that he didn't go, you know, like he took basically what Jimmy Lake had and kind of what Lake and Chris Peterson recruited and turned that into a team that, you know, dominated the Pac-12. They were, you know, 3-0 against the really talented Oregon team the last 2 years, and they beat Texas, and, you know, they played for the national title. To me, that's that's you're making his argument, not arguing against him, I think.
So, Stu, I'll throw it to you, but it also speaks to this idea of, and this is not necessarily me being critical of either of you, it's just sort of stating the fact that it's so hard to weigh expectate, because part of how you judge success is compared to expectations. So we're sort of dinging Kelly because expectations are at LSU, of course, are much higher than at Kansas. And with Kalen DeBoer, the expectations when he walked into a struggling Washington program were relatively low, though Washington is a place where you often win. And now he will be judged against Alabama level expectations. So he will probably still be the same coach, but it becomes really hard. Part of the reason why this exercise is so hard, if you want to take it seriously, and I think you guys do take it seriously, even though it's just a conversation starter, is because all success and failure is relative to expectations. So I can look at Brian Kelly's record and look at Lance Leipold's record of the last couple of years and say, yes, but.
Yeah, I'm always trying to measure guys against the expectations of that school. And oftentimes, like, you know, somebody like Matt Campbell, for instance, some people look at him and go, wait, why are you guys still talking about him the way you are? Losing record 2 years ago, 7-6 last year. He's still the first Iowa State coach since 1925 to have a winning record in conference play. So you're always evaluating it compared to the school itself. I just want to say, though, that it's not like I was like, you know, no brainer, Lance Leipold 2, Kalen DeBoer 3. Again, the void that was created made it so that whoever I put in those spots, I think, would have been jarring. Maybe Dabo would have seemed safer, but I think that, you know, there would be people arguing against it. And Brian Kelly, too. I mean, I'm with Bruce on that one. Like, it's what he's the winningest coach in Notre Dame history. He took LSU to the SEC title game his first year. And so those are the reasons I have him ranked as high as I do at number 6. But I can't really justify higher than that when he is so far kind of basically held serve. He's not. Like, Kalen DeBoer did not hold serve at Washington. That stat Bruce said about 10-1 against top 25 is kind of insane. And who would have guessed? Who would have dreamed? You know, I thought a good coach could come in there and rebuild Washington pretty quickly, because it did seem like something had just gone wrong with Jimmy Lake, and there was more talent there than that record would indicate. But none of us would have predicted they'd be playing in the national title game 2 years later.
So I will say, I'll give you credit for this one. And you knocked, you bumped up Kyle Whittingham, I think, to number 8, Stu. I like the idea, Bruce, that you went right to the top 5 with Whittingham. He's probably a guy who's been perpetually underrated for years.
I moved him from 8 up.
I think you're trying to give Stu credit, and I'm the one who had him 8. So. Yes.
Oh, I'm sorry. So yeah, that is right. I got your list mixed up here. So Stu, good job by you putting Kyle, taking that opportunity to take the perpetually underrated Kyle Whittingham out. Because I found myself looking at that move thinking, yeah, I think in a year where there's a void, I might give Whittingham a little shine. And the one nitpick I had, and again, this is one where I kind of agreed with Stu, because he seemed to be leaning into more of what has this guy done throughout his career. And I was a little surprised that you didn't give more shine to Mike Gundy, Bruce. You have him at 20. And man, Gundy, again, another year where, like, how did that team end up in the Big 12 championship game? You know, since there is a void and there is this changing of the guard, I like the fact that Stu bumped Gundy into the top 10.
So, my hesitation on him, I had him 20th. And, you know, again, it's still not bad. But here's the thing. In the last 6 years, which is a fair sample size, they had 3 years where they were not even ranked. And I think they're honestly, that is the most wide open league, right? There's no Ohio State, Michigan, or even Penn State in the Big 12. Yeah, there's Oklahoma, but you had Texas was going through a lot then. I just looked at it and was like, okay, you know, like there was 1 year where they were a top 15 team, and then the other 2 years, you know, what was interesting was when we did this last year, I didn't have Gundy at all, because that that was 2 years out of the previous five that he had had ranked teams. And coming off, they had a really tumultuous year last off season. Players were leaving. You heard a lot of chatter about some of why they were leaving. And it felt like the program was reeling. You know, they went 10-4. You know, he found a great running back. He recruited and found a great running back. And they went 10-4. And it was a strong year. And I did have him in the top 20. But he's another one, and I don't want to say, like, you know, put it quite in the category of Brian Kelly, but he's been, you know, one of the more consistent winners, you know, in there. And I think he's established a strong program, you know, and I think that brand has been elevated quite a bit in the last 25 years. But it's hard. You start, you know, you use the word nitpick, and you start nitpicking guys in here where I'm like, all right, I go through this, and the guys I have in front of them, I had Josh Heupel in front of them. Well, I know how awful Tennessee was in the big ditch for a long time, and Josh Heupel went 11-2 and resurrected the program, and then they didn't really fall back last year, even though they lose Hendon Hooker. I have a lot of respect for Matt Rhule. It wasn't a great first year, but I thought what Matt Rhule did at Baylor was an amazing job, and he also went from 2-10 at Temple to 10 wins 2 years later. So I wasn't, you know, like, I wasn't going to put Matt Rhule down. There's another one, Kirk Ferentz. I know Stu has his really strong feelings about him. Kirk Ferentz, what I think he's done has been pretty amazing there. And you just kind of go through the list of the Chris Klimans or, you know, Sark. There's just a lot of guys that I was like, you know, it's hard for me to put him in front of those guys necessarily. But I'd put him, you know, around them.
So, yeah, Stu is the OG Kirk Ferentz hater. And I'm not going to get into describing the history of it. Just go Google it, folks. And I half kid that, Stu, but I also wanted to spin the conversation away from just your list and to this idea of matching expectations and what are expectations for success going to be. We've talked about this a lot in the new world of college football, where you have the super conferences and a stacked Big Ten and a stacked SEC, and even to a certain degree in the Big 12, where now all of a sudden those bell cow teams are gone. And if you're Matt Campbell, you sort of made a reputation on beating Oklahoma and Texas when Iowa State never did that. And I'm wondering, a year from now, a couple of years from now, as we see the new college football take place or take shape, what's that going to mean for expectations on coaches and the comings and goings, and not just on your rankings, but, you know, as we've seen before in the rankings, Dan Mullen is a top 15 coach 1 year, and a year later he is fired.
Fired, yeah.
Yeah, so I'm kind of wondering, Stu, as you project forward a little bit on the new world order of college football, what's that going to mean for the way we judge coaches?
Well, two things. You know, you referred to my list as volatile. I think it'll become annually volatile because of two things. Like, some of these guys that we have ranked, let's say, 17th right now, are going to step up and become the new faces of the sport. You know, there's with the void, like, who's going to be the new Harbaugh, the new whatever, you know, like, I don't think there's going to be a new Saban. And, you know, maybe that's Sark, who I was too, you know, he only had this past year was his first really great season. So I didn't feel comfortable ranking him in the top 10 yet. But if they go back to the playoff next year, maybe win it, he's going to jump up the list. I think just like I evaluate these coaches relative to expectations at their school, I think fan bases are going to judge their coaches. There's a certain tier of schools, and we know what they are, right? They're upper half of the SEC, top six, I would say, of the big brand name schools who, in this new world, in a 12 and possibly 14 team playoff, it's going to be playoff or bust. It's no longer going to be like, well, we won 9 or 10 games and we beat our rival and we went to the Citrus Bowl. Like, no, that'll be considered just like in the NFL. If you don't make the playoff, it doesn't matter what your record is. If you missed the playoff, that was a bad season for those fan bases. I'm not saying, like, you know, Kansas State fans are going to be like, well, we missed the playoff 2 years in a row, we should fire Chris Klieman. And, you know, everything's relative. But for the Alabamas, Georgias, LSUs, Ohio States, like any season you don't make the playoff is a failure. And so if you're the coach and you miss the playoff at that school 2 years in a row, certainly 3 years in a row, yeah, I think they're going to be out. It's going to become very NFL-like in terms of the churn of head coaches at those schools.
Bruce, can you imagine a world? Well, but let's, I think you're right generally, but again, I think, and I'll throw this one to Bruce, like there's going to be some adjustment to a certain degree of, hey, I went 9-3 and that was good enough to make the playoff. I mean, listen, there are people in at LSU, you talked about Brian Kelly and what he's done over the last couple of years, and he won an SEC West title, and that was surprising in his first year, and then things didn't go so well last year, and people were very disappointed, but they still ended up 10-3. Do we get to a point where, hey, I went 9-4 and I made the playoff, but I lost the playoff game? Are we still firing certain guys, do you think, Bruce?
Yes.
Yeah.
I think it depends on the school. I think there will be superpower schools. Like, look, you just mentioned Brian Kelly. I think if Brian Kelly does not win a national title in the next 2 years, I don't think he's going to be there longer than that.
Okay.
I mean, LSU is different than almost every school. I would, Ohio State's in a weird spot because, you know, like he's got Ryan Day has got a remarkable record, but he's lost the last three games to the one school you can't lose to. Now, I think that Michigan is there for the taking right now because there's a little bit of a rebuild going on.
Yeah, I think that'll fix itself this year. I suspect.
But LSU, and I've said this before, the last three coaches who've been there each won national titles. Like that doesn't happen anyplace else, you know? And so if you don't like getting to the playoff, you go 9-3, that ain't going to impress anybody there. And by the way, the AD there, he loves to throw money around and loves to make splashy hires. You know, if Brian Kelly goes 9-3 or 10-4 and loses and doesn't make it to the title game or something in the next 2 years, I wouldn't feel very comfortable if I was him that I was going to be there. You know, like the other schools I would say fit in that category, like Ohio State. I don't want to say it's national title or bust because I think, you know, but there is a lot of pressure there given the money that was stepped up to do that. I would think that's a place that's like that. You know, Alabama.
I could just throw one counterpoint to that in there. Mm-hmm. Like I agree with Bruce in that in terms of the expectations. But given the college football calendar and the pressure everybody faces to, like, if you're going to make a coaching change, you got to know who your next coach is going to be in time for the transfer portal window opening. Like, will schools be able to wait until January 2nd to see if their coach
wins?
They will do it because schools are very reactionary at the end of the day. Hmm. Like, think about this. None of us, I don't think, you know, when it initially was put in writing, thought Texas A&M would be able to marshal up, you know, $80 million to dump Jimbo Fisher. But heck yeah, they did. You know, I mean, there's a few schools, not a lot. Like, I don't think, like, you know, Jonathan Smith is listening to the podcast. It's not your school. You know, it's like there's a bunch of schools that I wouldn't say, you know, the playoff will be good enough for a while. But there's probably a small handful that making the playoff, oh, it's a 14-team playoff. That isn't really that much. You know, that's like going to a New Year's Day Bowl or a New Year's Six Bowl.
No, I agree. I'm just saying, will they just rip off the Band-Aid at the end of the regular
season?
Yes,
they will. Well, yeah. I don't know if they'll rip off the Band-Aid and say, oh, your team, like, again, go back to Kelly. There was the year he jumped, you know, left Notre Dame. Technically, Notre Dame still could have, you know, been in the big picture.
Right. Very small chance, though.
Yeah, I suspect if there's a coach whose team is 9-3 and, you know, the number 11 seed or something, I don't think they would fire him because what are you doing to the players then at that point to have going to the playoff? But I just think after the playoff, once you lose, I think for a couple of those places, they'll be like, yeah, especially if, you know, like this, I don't think it's this is the right example. But remember when Ohio State was like marching to the you know, to the year of the national title and they beat Wisconsin 59 to nothing, or the year, I think it was Major Appleboy was the head coach at Houston, who it was a school where they lost by like 60 in a bowl game.
Right.
And it was just
That
such a
was it.
jarring thing.
Yeah.
Like, I think if anything, with more eyeballs on the playoff, if a team that like, you know, is 9-3 and in there and loses to like loses a whatever, a 5-7 game or whatever it would be, and they get upset, I just think you'll see that much more reactionary stuff.
Let me throw this in here, Stu, as we head down the home stretch, and I'll frame it this way, because I do want to. I almost think that we are not letting our imaginations stretch here. If the especially if the SEC eventually goes to 9 conference games, and hell, man, I mean, you know, we've talked about this. The Super League might be happening in front of our eyes, and we're not really comprehending it because, but it actually might be here. What if we get to the point where we see, like, you know, I think we could be heading to a world where all of a sudden the SEC champion regularly loses 2 or 3 games. Like, I think that we might be moving, like, it might be very jarring over the next couple of years when we see very good teams losing 2 or 3 games. And you're right, they'll be judged by the playoff and how you do in the playoff. But I just wonder if we're not expanding our horizons here to the idea that this may look very much like the NFL, especially
exactly
in the Big Ten, especially in the Big
exactly
Ten and the
looks.
SEC, and really to a certain degree, even in the other conferences, because I think those conferences will be pretty darn competitive. So you really are looking at a situation where multiple losses every year are just a thing, and yeah, I just wonder how fans will react to that, and because they do influence what ADs end up and programs end up doing, what schools end up doing to the coaches. So I just think that, like, we are walking into a little bit of the unknown, and it's going to be a little jarring as we reset what the expectations are. I understand making the playoff is sort of like a good bar to set it at, but I wonder if we are underrating how many more losses teams are going to start piling up.
Well, especially if the Big Ten and SEC get their way, you know, in terms of the negotiations over 2026 and beyond. Yeah, it's very unpopular. It's going to be very unpopular. I think we can agree if they have a system where they're preordained, the SEC and Big Ten are preordained 3 automatic berths. They want 4, right? But let's say 3.
And if I could just interject, Stu, like, this is one of the reasons why they want those, because their ADs and their coaches want that security of, hey, we're going to at least get a bunch of teams in the playoff. And partially from the ADs, it's like, I don't want to fire my coach after a 9-3 season, right? Because
and
we didn't
wanna
make
take
the playoff.
The decision. Yeah, and they want to take the decision out of the committee's hands. They want to just say, because look, these teams are going to be playing wildly unbalanced schedules. And some of them are going to play aggressive non-conference schedules and some of them are not. So they want it to be, hey, whoever finishes top 3 in our standings knows they get to go to the playoff. And then it doesn't particularly matter if, like, you know, Alabama last year loses to Texas out of conference. Let's say they lost to Texas out of conference and they lost 2 SEC games. Oh no, they went 9-3. Oh, but they finished 2nd in the SEC, so they're going to the playoff. Like, yes, we could absolutely see situations where, you know, a team, the SEC champ is 9-3, 10-3, and
it's not a fluke.
12-1,
right? And that's the difference. Like, it's not a fluke.
But they're just the better team.
Yeah, it's because they have simply had a schedule where all of a sudden they played a bunch of top 7 or 8 teams, and I just, again, I find myself wondering what the world looks like with that. And I, you know, and I'll throw it to you, Bruce, and then we'll close it out from here. Is that idea of, do you think? I also wonder from this, if I want to take it even one step further, if that's one of the things that stops Super League. If what we see over the next couple of years is a bunch of schools going, wait a second, we don't want to have 8-4 be a good, like, we can't sell to our fans 8-4 is a good year, but man, like, with these schedules, like, 8-4 is maybe the best that we can do. So I do wonder if maybe that's one of the things when we see this reality, and if you're Tennessee or Oklahoma, and you're Oklahoma especially, has been used to winning Big 12 championships, and you crank out a bunch of 8 and 9 win seasons, and you're thinking, wow, we're pretty good, but like we can't seem to get past this point. I do wonder if that's the thing that finally makes people go, hey, maybe we don't want the Super League. Maybe we don't want 3 more awesome teams in this league.
I think it's real. Look, Ralph, you and I more probably than Stu grew up on the NFL. And I think this is going to be much more like the NFL. The schedule, the season's longer or will get longer. You know, we see it's much more transactional already to a certain degree of free agency. And that's where it's already trended there. So I just think the outcomes are going to move that way too. I mean, there's a term that you don't get used to in college football, but I think it's more of a thing, and that's parity. That's way more common. I mean, you know, I know you grew up a Jets fan, but like, how many times did the Giants not have like a great regular season but won a Super Bowl? You know, yeah, like
way too often, frankly.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think that's kind of where this feels like it is headed. And, you know, what is the consumer going to think? You know, what is the fan going to think? I think a lot of times college football fans are college football fans, and they're going to stay with that because that is, you know, that's like, to me, you know, it's a little different. Like, you know, NBA and NFL fans sometimes are partnered together because it's like, you know, cities and you grow up that way, whereas colleges are a little different. I just think fans will adjust because they almost have no choice not to.
Yeah, I mean, you know, what you are describing, Bruce, is exactly what our friend Ari Wasserman has been bemoaning in columns for 2 to 3 years now, right? That's going to render the regular season meaningless if you can go 9-4 and still make the playoff. You know, he's not wrong that the stakes of the individual games are going to be lower, but I agree with you. Like, all of these threats, right? The NIL is going to ruin the sport. Transfer portal is going to ruin the sport. Realignment is going to ruin the sport. And then, you know, Dennis Dodd, our friend, just had a story yesterday that attendance, this is the first time in God knows how long that attendance was up in back-to-back seasons. Every week, ESPN or Fox or CBS, the highest rated games since such and such. And so people adjust. And I think the people who say X is going to underestimate just how loyal people are to their schools in a way that I think is much deeper than their allegiances to their pro sports teams. We have somebody on our staff who, not our college football staff, but the athletic staff, who went to Kansas and is a diehard Kansas fan and went to every game during that 13-year period where they were going 1-11 every year, right? Like, it takes a lot to turn people off from college football who are college football fans. And we will adjust. I think at first people, there'll be a lot of complaining. This isn't the way I grew up on it, blah, blah, blah. But the Saturdays, man, you can't top a college football Saturday. You really can't. And I don't think the size of the playoff is going to change that.
I'll put a bow on it with this. Do never underestimate America's obsession with football in general. And then you add the college element to it and the passion you have, then that link and that connection, that emotional connection you have with your school, and you throw in the love of football in general, it's a hell of a drug. Stuart Mandel and Bruce Feldman from The Athletic, they have their dueling top 25 college coaches list. Always great, always entertaining. Thank you both for joining the show this week. And hopefully I'll see you guys in person at some point soon.
All right. Thanks, Ralph.
And now 3 and Out. First down. It's only fair that I do a coach's list, so here we go, though I'm keeping this to a top 10. And remember, I tend to be extremely conservative with my rankings and definitely lean into a coach's entire career. I remember sticking with Jim Harbaugh in the top 20 even after the season he almost got fired, so in the long run, that worked out pretty well. So here we go. As I said with Bruce and Stu, number 1 is Kirby Smart, number 2 is Dabo Swinney, and I'll stick with Brian Kelly at number 3. Number 4, I have Ryan Day. And frankly, this is the toughest one. No matter where I put Day on this list, I have regrets and doubts. Just like I didn't judge Harbaugh solely on the Ohio State games for years, I'm not going to judge Day solely on the Michigan game. I don't think we should take for granted that Ohio State has continued to function at a ridiculously high level as a program since Day took over for Urban Meyer. But there is a reason why Harbaugh's born on third base zinger has stuck to Day. It's hard to mess up Ohio State. I'll stick with Day at four, but I hear your criticisms. They are valid. I also think you'd have a hard time convincing me that the guys behind him are clearly better. The guys behind him. Number five, I'll go with Kyle Whittingham from Utah. Again, I feel like he's been perpetually underrated, even though he's not coming off the best of seasons. A lot of injuries in Salt Lake City. I'll stick with Kyle at number five, especially at a time when there's a lot of turmoil and new faces in the top 10. Number six, Kalen DeBoer, now at Alabama, previously at Washington. Number seven, again, I'll stick with somebody who's got a long track record of success, even though he gets dinged on the big game, can't win the big game criticism. That's James Franklin from Penn State at number seven. Number eight, I'll go with Lance Leipold. I know it seemed like I was being a little harsh with Leipold, but as I said, I was an early endorser of Leipold even when he was at Buffalo because I do consider what he did at Wisconsin Whitewater, turning that into a perennial national championship program in Division III. I think that counts. Winners win. Leipold's done an amazing job at Kansas. I'm just going to hold back a little bit because I think that there are some other guys, I feel like, in DeBoer's case, who have reached a little higher levels of success at the highest levels of college football. So Lance Leipold slips in at number eight. I'll go with Mike Norvell at number nine, also a little bit of a tough one, but I keep going back to body of work. Even though Norvell has only had two big seasons at Florida State, he also did very well at Memphis, taking a program that was trending up and bringing it to even higher heights. And since he has been gone, Memphis has got a little bit of a dose of reality. It's not easy to win big at Memphis. It's definitely better positioned now than it was for years and years before Norvell and really Justin Fuente got there. But nonetheless, what Norvell did at Memphis was really impressive. You combine that with his time at Florida State, and I'll go with number nine for Mike Norvell. Frankly, number nine with a bullet, it wouldn't surprise me at all if he's in my top five as soon as next year. Number 10, Lincoln Riley. I'm cutting Riley a fair amount of slack here. There is no doubt his career is at something of a crossroads, but he is also 74-18 as a college football coach with only one season, last season at USC, during which he has lost more than two regular season games. Quick note on Mike Gundy, because I made such a big stink about Bruce leaving him out of his top, well, barely in his top 20 at number 20, while Stu had him at number 9. Clearly, he didn't make my top 10, but frankly, I probably would have had Gundy at number 11. I toyed back and forth with Norvell, Riley, and Gundy in those final two spots. I think we do underrate how much of a difference Oklahoma State under Gundy has been than Oklahoma State historically has been. And because he lacks some of the quote-unquote big wins and championships, I think we underrate his tenure there. But after another big season, I think he's built up a long enough resume that at this point, when you have fewer coaches who have built up long resumes of success, his deserves a nod. He was just out of my top 10. Just remember, this stuff is impossible to do, but it's also fun to do. Second down, the new early signing period became an official thing last week. The mid-December period that was smack dab in the middle of the portal window and bowl season prep is now going to land between the final weekend of the regular season and conference championship games. So right after Thanksgiving, right before the first full weekend in December. I think it's an improvement, but still a bad idea that will lead to more in-season firings and sped up coaching searches. I think they should have punted that signing period altogether. A June signing period that would go into effect in 2025 is also still under consideration. Third down, programming note. So we're going to keep pumping out football podcasts in the height of college basketball season, and with me covering a lot of college basketball over the next few weeks. At times, I have pivoted to a little hoops at this time of the year, but we're sticking with what we know best on the pod, so you can come back for more in the next few weeks to continue to find your college football fix. That is the show for today. I'd like to thank my producer, John Radcliffe, for making me sound good. You can find this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, just about anywhere you like to get your pods. Please follow, please, please, please follow so you do not miss an episode. I'm Ralph Russo, the college football writer with the Associated Press. Thanks for listening, and come back for more, yes, next week, of the AP Top 25 College Football Podcast.